This episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur is sponsored by NowSite Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. Bring all your digital marketing to a new level with their simple three-click method. And by Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet, the secure high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
And sometimes you learn more, I guess, from failing than you do, but nobody wants to do it. But you better be ready for it because it's going to happen. I don't know where it's going to happen and how, but you know.
100%. Yeah. And so I would say that was the last step grasshopper in my training. When I failed with this, I spent 9 months in a warehouse every day trying to get rid of the goods, because once you fail, you know, nobody wants to buy them. And so, by the way, if somebody does want to buy them, take the first price, because it never gets
liquidated. Get out, right?
Even if you take a loss on it. I mean, people get wrapped up, and my partner got wrapped up, and God bless him, he's a great guy, but he got wrapped up in like, okay, we built him for $4.35. We can't sell him for below that.
Right.
We got an offer for all of them for like $3.50.
Oh. Right.
Oh, we turned that down. We ended up selling them probably on an average of $2 a piece, you know.
Yeah, so you want to mitigate your losses at that point, not maximize, right?
That's right. And also
like
time.
Falling stock.
Yeah, and time is money too, and opportunity.
Yeah, very much
so. I thought the biggest thing for me is the opportunity cost, the 2 years that I wasted on this.
You know, I don't think that people really understand from an economic standpoint what opportunity cost is, that it's the alternate use of your time or your money. So if you can liquidate these things for $3.50 or $3 now, instead of holding on to it for a year, not only could you have deployed that money into something else, but you also gave up a year of your life.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and if something's decreasing in value, hit the bid.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Hey everyone, it's Mitch, your host, and welcome to today's show. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit BeinhackerLaw.com or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, my name is Warren Tuttle. I serve as the president of the United Inventors Association. We're the largest 501c3 nonprofit inventor education group in the United States. And then professionally, I wear a few hats. I run open innovation programs for several large companies, including Lifetime Brands, the largest housewares company in the United States. I've been a lifelong entrepreneur and been in my own business, paying myself for over 40 years.
All right, Warren. So welcome to the podcast. I appreciate you coming on and talking to me about all the inventions you've been a part of and UIA, because frankly, I hadn't heard about UIA till Andrea introduced us, but it makes sense that there would be a whole association of inventors. I've been approached by companies before, you know, those companies out there that say, hey, do you have an invention? You can work with us. But I don't know too much about the inventor community, except, you know, I know, see cool things that people invent. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about, you know, where you're from, what your background is, and how you kind of got into the serial entrepreneur world of inventions. Does that sound like a good idea?
That sounds awesome. Okay. So yes, yeah. I watched Lawrence of of Arabia the other night, and I don't know if you remember the movie, but it ends with him dying at the beginning, and we go back. So we'll just start at the beginning and then go back to the beginning.
Perfect. Of
the movie. I do serve as the president of the United Inventors Association, which I'm sure we'll refer to during the interview as a UIA. So that's what it means. But we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and all that means is we have to adhere to federal regulations on making sure that we run an ethical and honest above board association like other people do in other fields.
Sure.
Ours specifically is in the field of inventor education.
Okay.
Obviously there's what we try to do is provide free information to inventors to help them on their path. We also do something really cool. We run a lot of industry trade events where we do booths and inventor booths and at the hardware show, and we've done the houseware show in the past, PGA Golf Show and so forth. And then we also try to advocate. We're not lobbyists, we advocate for inventors in Washington, D.C. We're also very involved with the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay,
we know everyone from top to bottom. So we try to be a voice for the inventor community. We have a board of 15 people, and if people want to learn more about us, they can go on our website, which is UIAUSA.org. That's UIAUSA.org.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to it also.
Awesome. But that's kind of the end of the movie. and by the way, we're always looking, to help people in a nonprofit way. And although the people on our board have businesses, they're an incredible collection of people. We have patent attorneys that are among the best in the country. I'm on the National Pro Bono Patent Commission. One of our members runs that. Mike Lindell of MyPillow fame, who's grown a company to record heights, is on our board. We have everybody on our board is contributes in some wonderful way. So,
okay, good.
But as far as my role and how I got here, I'm a lifelong serial entrepreneur. I probably like a lot of people of my generation. I started with a paper route. When I was 9 years old.
Right. You're the third guy I've spoken to in 3 days that started with paper routes when. An age where you couldn't do that nowadays. You can't get a paper when you're 9 now in 2020.
No. And my older brother had like 40 customers and a widespread empire. At the time, it seemed like the Mongol Empire, but right. I just took over Charter Oak Drive. That's how I got started.
Yeah, it was money for you. It was probably a fortune, right? You actually had your own money.
Well, I made about $2 a week. And then, it's amazing. I would always have $50, $60 so I could buy bicycles and things.
And it went far in those days.
Yeah. I always tell a funny story that my mother used to borrow money from my jar all the time and leave me notes. But it was a great way to get started. And then I was sort of, I always liked working, I don't know why. I was a kid that would clean out the garage,
Right.
So I was shovels, when it snowed, we were out with the snow shovels. When I got older, I had a Jeep and a plow.
Yeah, and you really make some money, right? And get a lot of driveways done.
Exactly. I had a window washing business when I was in college, which I started with a partner. First week we had no business. By the end of the summer, we had about 50 people that we had to go back to college. So we had to line them up for the next summer. And
that's funny.
Figure that out. And so when I was in college, many years ago, I went to a small liberal arts college in upstate New York. And I was trying to think about what I wanted to do when I got out of college and was getting into my own business, but I didn't have a lot of experience or know-how. So along the way I interviewed with a lot of companies and, some funny stories there, but,
Feel free to share a funny story if you want.
Well, one of them I took an interview with Procter & Gamble. They had a sale, it was a sales job, and it's an entry-level sales job. And a lot of people who are going places, went to work for Procter & Gamble, a wonderful company, a lot of successful people. But I was not cut out really for it. I kind of came in with long hair and, probably a little
short. And that was selling wholesale to retail, right? You're going... Because they didn't sell directly to the public. They sold their stuff through
retailers, but mostly grocery stores and that type of thing. And those entry-level jobs, they would get the college kids to go out and stock the shelves. And, you learn from the ground up. And interestingly enough, we'll get back to it later, but A.G. Laffley, who was the chairman of Procter & Gamble, had a lot of influence in my Open Innovation Program. But back at the time, when I was, coming out of college, I took the interview. And it was really funny because I could tell about 5 minutes into the interview, I was not who they were looking for. And it was a half an hour interview. And the guy said to me, "Would you like to see our assortment of products?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" So he starts taking me through this book, and it has, Pampers, and it has, toilet paper, and it has, And after about the third page, I put my hand out in the middle of the book, and he looked up kind of startled. I said, this isn't really working out, is it? He goes, no. And I go, I said, well, what are we wasting our time for? And at the time, I used to smoke cigarettes, and he had a pack of cigarettes. I said, let's go down and have a smoke. And we went down, and had a smoke for about 25 minutes, and we talked about life. And at the end, he said, you're going to go places, kid, but just not with us.
That's funny. Yeah, but you're honest about it, right? You build a relationship. That's networking.
It was great.
I didn't know it at the time, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I had no interest in selling toilet paper.
I don't blame you.
That's not great. But what I did have an interest in, there was a store called Abraham and Strauss, and I'm not sure.
Sure, I remember Abraham and Strauss.
We had stores in Paramus and Woodbridge. And
A&S.
Yeah, A&S. And so they had about 15 stores around the New York City area, based in Brooklyn, New York. And they in their promotional material, when
they were a department store like Macy's and yes, Bloomingdale's, yeah. Right? Yeah, I remember.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, we were a sister store to Bloomingdale's. We were a federated department store.
Federated, sure.
Bloomingdale's got a lot of the attention, but A&S Hall had all the merchants, you know? And, you know, it was a New York City, Brooklyn-based store. And most of the kids that worked there were New York City-based, you know? I was this WASP from Connecticut, right? That went down for the interview because my dad said, if you really want to learn retailing, go to work at Abraham Strauss. They're the best merchants in the world. And so, but what happened was they would put in all their promotional literature, run your own business. That was their become a buyer. And this appealed to me. I had my own businesses. I wanted to get into my own business. And for some reason, you know how in life, you know, things jump out at you and it just appeals to you. And
right.
This appealed to me to go to Abraham and Strauss. And I interviewed, got the job there. I was one of 105 kids in my college graduates, recent college, in my first training program. And four or five of us made buyer, you know, after a couple of years.
Well, how are you in your own business if you're a buyer? Explain that.
Well, you know, a store, any retail store, whether it be Macy's or A&S or Bloomingdale's, it's made up of many independent departments.
And right.
A&S, sure. Like anywhere else, we had about 200 departments. You know, you could be the men's tie buyer or you could be the women's lingerie buyer.
Oh, is that specific?
Oh, well, even more so. You probably had several different divisions of women's lingerie. And right. In the housewares area, which is where I was assigned, we had 8 different departments. We had small electrics, cookware, cutlery, you know, yeah, novelty.
Sure. That makes sense.
All these right. things. So they assigned me to housewares, you know, when I came in, I was taking the training program, learning how to be a merchant, doing things for a profit and so forth. And I really took to it. It was a combination of very hands-on physical work because, you know, although you wore a tie and jacket, it was a lot of entry-level stuff. You had to make sure the floor was filled in. You had to learn, you know, how to use the cash register. You had to, you know, it was a great training. And a lot of kids dropped out in the beginning because they thought they were going to come into the ivory tower. They thought it was banking or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, start, you know, with
on the floor, right? They're like,
you're on the floor. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I did well because I ran down to the basement 3 times a day and filled in the floor. That's why we would do sales. Yeah.
So you were kind of running the division or the department as your own business.
Yes, that's correct. And I came in first as a trainee. Then I was, they said, oh, you're a WASP from Connecticut. You're going to run the Christmas shop.
There you go. Perfect.
Right thing. I'm sure anyone
that's
from
not PC York, nowadays, but they could do that. No.
But anyone from the New York area can appreciate the humor. And I, you know what? It was a wonderful environment. I loved it. You know, people were rough and tumble, and they were tough merchants, but they were always fair and above board, and you always knew where you stood. And I like that. You know, not everybody, not for everybody, you know, it wasn't a political environment. It was more of a, and I learned, and I had great bosses, and I had tough bosses. And I'll tell you, the first 2 years were really hard, and there's a couple times when I wanted to drop out, and only because, you know, it was almost like boot camp, like military boot camp.
Right.
But if you survived it, you know, I learned all types of things about merchandise, and I learned, you know, how to fill in the floor, how to do the cash register, but more importantly, right. how to negotiate deals, how to learn about margins, you know, how to use your calculator, how to do things for profit, how to go to the warehouse and get goods through, how to, you know, we go around the country to trade shows and product selection, and even over sourcing overseas. So I had a great base, and then I became the youngest buyer in Federated at 23 years old. I became the buyer of one of the biggest departments in the store, the small electrics department. And quite frankly, that had a lot to do with my rabbi at the store. He took me under his wing, and you know, I wouldn't have gotten the job without him. So I recognized that, but it was a great opportunity. And for 6 years, you know, I worked my tail off. He eventually left. I did other things.
But you had moved up to the parent company. So now you were dealing with all the businesses that they owned.
Oh yeah, and I was in Brooklyn, and we had I bought for all electrics for all the stores, you know, all throughout Jersey, Long Island, and so forth. And it was a great experience. I was very young because most of the people were much older than me, but it was a great experience. I hung on for dear life. I learned a lot, and then I decided, you know, after 6 years, that I really, you know, didn't really enjoy living in New York so much. So I moved back out to Connecticut. I worked for a short period of time for a department store called Reed's. They're an Allied department store.
Okay. I think Stern, I've heard of Reed's. Yeah.
Stern's, this was a sister store in New Jersey. And
they're still
that.
Around or no?
Not. No, a long time. But like most of the stores, they're now Macy's, you know, on that side, I learned all the store line stuff, you know, I was an assistant store manager, how to manage a store, payroll, and all those things. So all along the way, I wanted to get my own business, right? I thought about it every day. So I left there and I started a store called The Complete Kitchen with a single store in Connecticut. And it was quite a come down. I went from sort of being a, you know, 27-year-old wonder child, you know, to going places and senior management to why would I give this all up? You got to be crazy, to back to a 1,500 square foot store. You know, I stocked it with about 6,000 specialty products, everything from Cuisinart food processors to, you know, mandolins and
right. Sure, products. It was like what Williams Sonoma is now. It's a kitchen place. They only sold. Yeah, there was a place in Livingston for years called the Kitchen Store, and they.
Oh well.
They're not there anymore, but they that's all it was. Everything from spatulas to, you know, equipment.
That's right, exactly. So and then I started a cooking school, which ended up becoming nationally renowned. As a matter of fact, I have a cover from Food and Wine magazine. They call us the top gourmet store in America.
Oh, nice!
And then I added a food business.
This was up in Connecticut.
Up in Connecticut, in Darien, Connecticut, sort of an affluent high-end town.
Right.
And so we had had seven people in the kitchen, and it was a variety of acquisitions and growth, and grew that out. So suddenly, I had 65 employees at one point. I had a lot of locations in Greenwich, Bronxville, Richfield, Wilton, Connecticut, and so forth. And I had a big store in Greenwich. And so I grew this operation out over 17 years, you know, and it was, we got a lot of acclaim. You know, I met Julia Child many times, had her come teach for us. Paul Newman was my partner for a while.
Really? Okay.
And we did a lot of catering for Paul. And it was a wonderful experience for a young man who really went back, in essence, which if I could say it, you know, all the things that I didn't learn at A&S, I learned on my own, you know, with my own money, my own bullets, and my own payroll. And
right, but unlike a lot of entrepreneurs that start a business like that, because obviously there's no barrier. You could rent a store, right, and you could stock it with stuff, but you had a lot of the business skills that you had developed by working for the large department stores, you know, whether it's payroll or operations or, you know, building a business. You know, a lot of people go into business and they don't have those backgrounds, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So and by the way, and also my business connections allowed me to be the first store in America. We became, you know, fairly well known in our little field of launching new products, like, you know, the Nespresso coffee capsules system.
We were
the first store in America.
I have both the old machine and the new machine.
The Krups, the old Krups and the new
one. I have the first Nespresso with the little capsules, and then we have the new one with the bigger ones.
Got it.
K-Cup one, whatever that one.
Well, the guy that started that program for Nestle's came over and lived in Greenwich. So I met him, and he came in the store one day and he said, you know, I'd love to launch this machine. It's a $500 machine. And I said, you know, you sure you want to do this?
For coffee? Yeah, what the?
Yeah, exactly. And he said, even for us, we were high end.
This was the Nespresso machine?
Nespresso. And he said, you don't understand. I'm from Nestle's. We're a pretty big company. And you know, I got an unlimited budget here, and we're selling millions of capsules already in Europe. We'd love you to be the first store in America to try
so
it out.
Guys, so that's where the Nespresso launched, was your store?
That's where it launched. And what was great was what he said to me. He said, well, here's what I'll do for you. He said, and you know, I'm a merchant, you know, always looking for where's the hidden trick in this thing, you know? And he goes, I'll use your company to cater to the party. We'll do a party in your store. We'll send out a mailing to your 100,000 on your mailing list. I'll give you 10 free machines and capsules for a month, and let's see how it goes. And I said, I was like, well, okay, this is, and he was so nice and so kind, and he was from Europe and he had a French accent, and he was like, okay, welcome to America. How am I going to, you know? And so we did this program. We sold all 10 machines the first night.
I'm sure.
We sold the first 300 machines in America before anybody ever heard.
It's a great model. It's basically a subscription model. You got to go get the, I know you can get capsules now from other places, but you basically got to go back to them and keep buying the capsules.
Oh, they wanted the bullet business from the beginning. They didn't care about the rifle, you know? And so, And then what would happen was, you know, it was different for us because when people came in the store and wanted capsules, we had to send them back, you know, but it was Amazon before Amazon, you know, you had to have it shipped to you. And
Yeah. Cause they didn't buy the capsules from you. They couldn't get refills from you.
They couldn't. We had like, you know, a box of them in case someone had an emergency. But
right, but they had ordered from Nestle, yeah.
They wanted the margin from that. And they were big.
Of course.
That's what they wanted. And it was a great relationship. We ended up putting a commercial machine into my food side. Anytime they wanted to test anything in America, they came in and built a – they built stands for us. They built – and then they flew my wife and I to Venice for a three-day worldwide meeting with all the other people that carried the product.
I hope it wasn't the time of year when the pigeons come out.
Well, actually, funny enough.
Because we went there on our honeymoon, St. Mark's Square, Cathedral, whatever, and there's pigeons crapping all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Well, what a great place to honeymoon. And
yeah,
I love
we did all of Italy. We got to get back. I've been meaning for 22 years to get back.
Oh, well, you'll love this. So what they did, this is Nestle's, right? You know, they're the biggest food.
Yeah, they got money.
Right, they got money. So you know what they did? In St. Mark's Square, you're going to love this, right behind the tower there.
Yeah.
They put a giant N, you know, the script N of the giant, and they filled it with bird seed, covered it with like Saran, and they took it off, and they had the world's largest pigeon feed and documented it, got it in the world's Guinness Book of Records. And we were
there
watching.
That's cool. That's funny. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. And then we stayed at the Daniele. I don't know where you stayed.
Sure. Well, we didn't. We were just kids. It's funny. We got there. We were in some second-rate hotel. You know, we were trying to save money. We get there, and the air conditioning's broken. And it's May, June, coming into June. There's bugs everywhere. I'm getting eaten alive. So we went to every hotel, including the Daniele. We said, I don't care what I got to spend for a room. I just need to sleep. Nobody had rooms available. Nobody. And we got stuck. We had to just sit within our rooms, and the windows were open. There were no screens on the windows. It was crazy. I looked like I had malaria from all the mosquitoes.
Well, yeah.
But it's a great city, especially as long as the tide's going the right way. And, you know,
it is. It's one of the great human experiences on the planet, you know, Venice, first time you go. But in any event, but I launched about a dozen other new items, the Don Vieux ice cream maker, the Mouli mincer, all types of items. So we got known, and because I've been an electrics buyer, you know, people was always calling me up, hey, we have a new product, would you mind testing it?
Right.
And so I got into that and had a lot of success as a merchant. And then really where my life changes, one day a guy named Tom Risch, who had invented a product called Misto, the gourmet olive oil spray, he walked into the store one day and says, I'd like to show you a product that I have. And I said, I'm kind of busy, but, you know, I'll give you a few minutes, you know, for sure. And we went back into my cooking school and we spent 4 hours while he showed me how the Misto worked.
Right. That's the stainless steel bottle. You fill it with oil, right? And you just, you do it yourself. You don't have to, of course, now they're disposable where you can just buy them. Yeah. There you go.
I always keep one close to me because it changed my life. And I, what happened was, I said to him, you know, as a typical merchant, you know, I said, look, I'll take 100 of them right now, you know, you bring them in, you pay freight, and this is what I'm going to sell, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, you don't understand. I'm an inventor. We haven't built them yet. And I go, the light bulb, like right behind me, went off in my head for the first time. This was in the fall of 1997.
Okay.
Probably right around the time you were getting married. And
I got married. Yep.
And I said, listen, let me help you. You know, do you have someone to help you take it out, advise you, and partner and so on? And he said, no. He says, I have someone, you know, to help me with fulfillment, and I have the tooling to build them, but I really, you know. And I said, he brought me on board. I teamed up with his, you know.
So he hadn't produced any product at that point? He just had like a
prototypes, yeah, just prototypes.
Okay.
So he ran the first 12 he made on an assembly line, you know, up in Bethel, Connecticut. I brought him in the store. I sold him the first day. You know, I put him on the floor. I mean,
there was nothing else out there at the time, right? Because I know there's competing products now, but yeah.
Nothing else. I would say at the end of the first day, I already knew we had a hit. And then he made 24 the next day. We sold all those. And so the rest was kind of history. I then took it around to all my friends in New Jersey, at the New Jersey stores, because I knew a lot of them. I knew the people in Mass. I knew all the gourmet shop owners from the shows.
Right.
And so they all started bringing them in. They all started selling them. And then I went back to my friends at Bloomingdale's and sold a couple thousand pieces in there. We built a big 8-foot Misto as a display. We brought them in. They sold 10,000 pieces the first Christmas.
Oh, wow.
History. Within a year, we sold 1.2 million Mistos. So,
wow.
And we were the number one product in Macy's everywhere. I mean, you would have loved it. We brought an 8-foot Misto into Macy's before 9/11, carried it right down the right into the Macy's cellar, right up down the elevator. You know, no one even checked us at the door what we were doing.
There's no security in those days.
Exactly. So I had all my stores. I had my 65 employees. I had Misto going on. And I decided this is crazy being in retailing where, you know, it's hard to make a living from year to year. And
right.
And I'm chasing my tail. So I sold all my stores and I focused on Misto. And then Tom, you know, was happy with what we had accomplished. I spent 4 years helping him. And he just didn't want to, you know, do other stuff or reinvest or take a risk. He'd made a lot of money. He could retire. And or at least, you know, roll things back. And right. So I wanted to go on. So I spent about a year trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I came back with another product that was a total bomb called Stir Chef. That was a saucepan stir. You know, I lost a lot of money. I'll talk about it in my book and everything. I mean, it was very painful. Yeah. A lot of the gains that I had made and the security I brought my family, I pissed away thinking I knew everything. And this was a device that would stir things on your stove. Took it to the house we were showing 2004 or 2005 and took 100,000 pieces of orders the first day. I thought I was going to be rich, and then the product didn't sell. So I learned a lot of. So if you're following, you know, as an education, right?
Yeah, sure.
Education, you know, being an entrepreneur, hard work, then learning from others, and doing right. your own business.
I always say, when you're an entrepreneur, you fail. It's not like will you fail if you take risks. You will. There's something you're going to decide. Like you said, you get bigger in your britches, or you make a bad decision and you learn. And sometimes you learn more, I guess, from failing than you do, but nobody wants to do it. But you better be ready for it because it's going to happen. I don't know where it's going to happen and how, but you know.
100%. Yeah. And so I would say that was the last step grasshopper in my training. When I failed with this, I spent 9 months in a warehouse every day trying to get rid of the goods, because once you fail, you know, nobody wants to buy them. And so, by the way, if somebody does want to buy them, take the first price, because it never
right.
gets
liquidate. Get out, right?
Even if you take a loss on it. I mean, people get wrapped up, and my partner got wrapped up, and God bless him, he's a great guy, but he got wrapped up in, like, okay, we built him for $4.35. We can't sell him for below that.
Right.
We got an offer for all of them for like $3.50. Oh,
right.
Oh, we turned that down. We ended up selling him probably on an average of $2 a piece, you know?
Yeah, so you want to mitigate your losses at that point, not maximize, right?
That's right. And also
like
time.
Falling stock.
Yeah, and time is money too, an opportunity.
Very much so.
I think the biggest thing for me is the opportunity cost, the 2 years that I wasted on this.
You know, I don't think that people really understand from an economic standpoint what opportunity cost is, that it's the alternate use of your time or your money. So if you can liquidate these things for $3.50 or $3 now, instead of holding on to it for a year, not only could you have deployed that money into something else, but you also gave up a year of your life.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and if something's decreasing in value, hit the bid. Right. You know, if you think it's going to gain in value, then, you know, lease it, stick with it, you know, but it's like
always speculative, right?
Yeah, but it's like your car rolling off the lot, you know, it's worth less from that minute. So now if you buy a Lamborghini, that's three of them in the world, and it's going to be worth twice as much next year, hang on to it.
Very few of those.
But, you know the drill. And so it was a painful, painful, painful lesson. But while I was in this warehouse, I kept going to call from a guy named Saul Palder, and he had invented a product that ended up being called SmartSpin eventually. And he had heard about me and what I did with Misto, and somehow through the grapevine, and could I help him? And he went to, you know, many other people that couldn't be of help. And I kept putting him off. I said, I gotta take care of my partners and, you know, and all the stuff that I'm doing and blah, blah, blah. And I'll get back to you when I can. God willing, you know, God, thank God that he didn't find someone else, because many months later I helped him, and it was basically a storage system for the shelf called Stir Chef that we put on TV, and it was that classic shot when you open your cabinet doors and all your containers.
Right, fall. And it's an organizational thing, right? They snap together, slide in, fit. Those are great TV sales things.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the first one of its type. You know, he had taken it to Rubbermaid. They turned it down, you know, and right. I said, I'll work with it. So we put it on TV, and we ended up selling over 10 million is the long nice. Story. So I went from, you know, being doing well to doing better to doing failing to losing everything to making it all back again. And so I had this up and down ride, which was then the third shift, a major shift in my life, when I decided that I would, this was crazy. You know, I had a couple other products. I had a fry pan, interesting Toss and Turn Fry Pan. I had a few others, but I was approached by Lifetime Brands, which is the largest non-electrics housewares company in America. Today, about $1 billion in sales with about 40,000 products, and they own the brand name Farberware and other brands. They
do business. Not a local mom and pop store.
Not a local mom and pop. Interestingly enough, located in Garden City, Long Island. So you know, And the principal of the company, the chairman, had been a buyer at Abraham and Strauss years before. And
people
that worked there were my old A&S buddies. So they had been following. You know, they had stayed in the retail, manufacturing, distribution arena. And they had noticed from afar what I was doing with all the products I was doing. And they said, how would you like to do something for us, to find new products? Because we're in constant search for that. And so we were able to put together a program where I was not an employee of the company, but I was an outside contractor. And they hired me to run their open innovation program, we ended up calling it, which is basically going outside the company for new ideas.
Yeah, you're sourcing ideas and opportunities, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And So I started with that.
It sounds like what you were really good at. That's how you were successful, because you know the market and you know how to get things out there, right?
It was right up my alley. I had a lot of experience with it. It seems like my whole life was pointing in that direction. It was great with a company of people I trusted. That was really important, honestly.
Of course, right.
Do the right thing, not trying to rip off inventors. I could liaison with my, at this point, I had gotten a lot more involved in the inventor community. I joined my local inventor club, kind of raised through the ranks of that, got involved with the National United Inventors Association. So it was all kind of coming together with me in an organic way that I didn't really realize at the time where I was going. I was kind of on this journey.
Right.
And I came in and we set up this wonderful program, and we've had a lot of success with it over the last 14 years. We've done over 100 licensing deals, and we've generated, over $100 million in business, and it's been phenomenal, and it's led to a couple of other programs. I started one with a power tool company called TTI. They make rigid and walkie and power tools. And although my tenure with them is ending because of management change, I've done that for many years. And I also did it with a direct response television company, Merchant Media. And between that and getting involved in my love for nonprofit efforts, because along the way I was president of my local chamber of commerce, and I always gave back, to the community. It's been a great run to sort of get out there in the inventor world, and so that's kind of what I've been doing these days. So that's sort of the platform. So it's been a fun ride, and I've learned a lot. So fire away. Any questions you have?
So you got involved in the UIA, and now you're the president, right?
Right.
And you also, and you're writing a book.
Yeah. Oh, let me. So over the years, many people have asked, "Why don't you write a book?"
There's got to be a book in there somewhere. That's what everybody says,
right? There's a book in there somewhere, and I never had the time really to write a book or whatever. And then what happened 2 years ago? A good friend of mine, Jeff Mangus. Jeff is an inventor. I've known him for many years, but had diabetes and sort of a tragic accident where he lost his leg. Oof. And so physically slowed him down, and he went back to his first love, which is writing. So he's written a few books. And
now a word from our sponsors. NowSight Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. It's everything you need to market online, and it's totally automated. Build custom websites, optimize them for Google rankings, and automatically create ads and social media posts to drive the most traffic to your sites. Their fully integrated system generates regular email newsletters, manages all your customers and prospects, and provides up-to-date marketing analytics. NowSight, you do your thing, and we'll do the marketing. Use our affiliate link in the show notes to learn more about NowSight and how it can help your business. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000, that's LAW to 21000, or follow our link in the show notes to learn how you can get this valuable tool for you and your company. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot.
Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their link in our show notes to learn more and get connected with Fetch. And now back to our show.
He's helping people, and he called me up. He says, you got to write a book. I said, I don't have to. He says, I'll help you write the
book. Right. Yeah. You can always get help writing books. Yeah,
exactly. So we have a very interesting relationship. I had to outline the book, which has been really interesting. The book, but the name of the book, by the way, is called Inventor Confidential.
Okay.
And the byline is the honest guide to profitable innovation. And the words were carefully selected. In part, the Inventor Confidential was a tribute to Anthony Bourdain and Kitchen Confidential and okay. his TV show, which I've always loved, Parts Unknown, which I'm a big fan of and love what he does there. And I love the food world and so forth. Although my book, trust me, Kitchen Confidential is a rock and roll book. And I recommend everyone read it, but it's not my book. My book is more what's really going on inside the invention world, because there are a lot of marketers out there. Like what you were talking about earlier, and they come in different sizes, shapes, and forms, and some are more clever than others. But at the end of the day, they're taking a lot of money from inventors, and there's no success with it. And I found over the years, the odds of success in our business are very low. I mean, the odds of success of having a hit product are pretty much the same as starting a band in your garage and, an album someday.
Yeah, it's one in a million, sure.
Making money on it. So I have a deep empathy because of coming close to, losing a lot of money and knowing what the downside of the business is of educating people. And that's why I get involved in a nonprofit like the UIA to give back. So I don't take any money from inventors. I get paid by companies, and of course I've been successful in other products, and I have a successful wife, and so I don't do things for money. I never make any decision on money. I love these platforms where I can get the nonprofit message out and try to educate people. You can put up my email later. Anybody that reaches out to me, I always give them a response.
Yep, we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Just try to help people, especially at my age. I'm not young anymore, and I would like to give back to others. But at the end of the day, the book is about what you really need to do to be a great inventor. Not this BS of sketch it on a napkin and send an Excel sheet type of nonsense.
Right.
That it takes extra hard work. It's not easy, and anybody that tells you is just trying to make money from you. And there's a lot of other challenges these days. There's challenges in Washington, D.C. with patent reform, which is driven by the big tech companies like Google and so forth. It's the United States Patent and Trademark Office, which follows rules and regulations set by Congress, but now has a PTAB system where you can actually, the same people that issue a patent can take it back away from you.
Right.
I mean, after you're in business. It makes sense for the big tech companies, but for independent inventors, it's really not in the spirit of 1792 when we started this country.
No, that's the whole point of patents, give you some protection.
Exactly. So I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. Also, I mean, you can tell by now my life's learning, reading, and absorbing and trying to figure out what's going on. So now part of the book is an advocacy for inventors, what to watch out for, and a call to arms. I'm not militant in that. It's just, let's wake up everybody and let's get America back to, look, everybody's fighting for the environment. Everybody's fighting for the economy, for racial justice, for all these wonderful things that people should be fighting for. And I just want to fight for innovation and what it takes to, to keep it going. Because if we want to be innovative, we have a great model, and we're in the process of pissing it away.
Right.
So I have a lot of passion on that front. So I run open innovation programs. I look at probably 20, 25 new products a day, which means thousands a year. I review things. I give feedback to people. I have with my companies at any given time, several that are, ready to license.
You're still consulting on products and helping launch and things like that.
Yeah, I'm still running the programs. People can go on my website, Tuttle Innovation, and see what I do.
Okay.
Still running around to trade shows when they happen. Now, mind you,
right.
Our big trade show of the year, the National Hardware Show, was postponed to September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. But we'll be out there for that, assuming it's running. And
what is that, in Vegas or something?
In Las Vegas, yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. We do a lot of educational stuff. We do pitch panels. We do all types of things to educate and help inventors along the way. And
right.
We have limited resources, but we do the best that we can to educate people. But at the end of the day, I'm professionally advocating for inventors, getting some of their deals licensed or educating them, helping them, on the educational front. And then also spending time in Washington, D.C. There are more militant inventor groups that are a little more lobby oriented and out like US Inventor that does a great job. We're supportive of their efforts, but we're more a little bit more of the educational, and we're more of a support, you know, organization for those efforts. But certainly have spent a lot of times in the halls of the Senate and Congress.
Yeah. And where do you get most of your financial support? Is it a member dues driven group? Do you get grants and stuff from the government? What?
Good question. We don't charge any membership fee at all. When I first got involved, it was membership free, but we made it a free concert. I'm a Woodstock generation, so free concert. We raise about half our money from our board of directors, which generously gives.
Okay.
Not all of them necessarily give money, but they give time, effort, and some sort of equity to the. And some have money. You know, some do very well, like Mike Lindell, who sold 57 million pillows, my pillows now. And we have others that, you know, or don't have that type of So we understand, and we want to get all types of people. We have a very diverse board, both in terms of the people and in terms of their professions. But we also raise probably most of the rest of our money through trade shows, where we put on, like, the National Hardware Show is the largest inventor booth pavilion in the country now, and with almost 200 booths. And the hardware show sells booths, and then we sort of get a commission on that because we set them up with it. And then we also, in addition to that, to the value
the
add.
The show is your show? The hardware show is your show, yes. Or no?
Well, the National Hardware Show is the National Hardware Industries show.
Okay.
National show with, you know, 50,000 people or whatever come to it. Okay. And Reed Expo is a company, a trade show company worldwide that runs the show for them. And so what we do is we contract with Reed to run a pavilion, like one hall that's just inventors.
And you can sell those spots and make money off of that.
Yeah, we do it in a variety of different ways, depending on the show, whether we sell it, they sell it. In this particular case, they sell, we make a commission.
Right.
But we don't just make a commission. We also, for the 3 days of the show, have a stage and fly in, you know, at our own expense and our own board members' expense, speakers, pitch panelists, and all types of people to continually educate during the show. It's alive. It's almost like a live band up on stage.
Right. But you have your own section, like you kind of bought out, and then you're selling it. I got it.
That's exactly right. So, and we do it for the PGA Golf Show. For many years, we did it with the Houseware Show. They took over themselves, but it's on the same model. So it's a good thing for inventors. We've done events at Toy Fair and other shows as well, and one of the pet shows. So we it's kind of a niche for us, and it's great trade show. A great opportunity for people to get out in their chosen field to really learn more about it, you know, get off the couch and get out there and learn instead of just, you know, spending money with a coach or something. So we have a variety of interests there, but that we do well there. Obviously the virus has hit us hard. A good deal of our annual, revenue comes from the hardware show, or a big chunk of it, you know, significant, probably 25% of them make for the year.
Right.
And that show didn't take place. So we've had to, you know, cut back a little bit on our services and cut down and hunker down a little bit like everybody else, see how this thing plays out. Sure. The hardware show was moved to September 1st, 2nd, 3rd. But
I'm hoping when this episode comes out, I'm starting in July to double up. So I'm going on Tuesday, Friday schedule. So this should be coming out in September. But I hope that the show will have gone on. I guess we'll find out in hindsight, and we'll be back out in the open again.
Well, hopefully. I mean, I just talked to the hardware show people last week. It's still scheduled, but it'll all depend on what buyers come and, you know, on their market, you know. And I don't think the big Home Depots are going to go necessarily. I think but all the Ace and True Value and independent hardware store owners probably be great timing for them. So we hope it goes on. But in any event, you know, we'll have shows again. We'll be on the cycle next
year. Order your logo masks, UIA logo masks. For people to give out at the, you're going to need it for sure. We'll see what kind of behavior people partake in the next few months. That's really what's going to depend on whether you're able to have that conference, have that trade show. It's really behavior in the next 60 days, 90 days, you know?
Yeah. I suspect we'll know. Yes, exactly. And probably soon. I have my hotel room, and my flight, but I guess it'll be interesting to see. If there's lesser numbers, if there's distancing there,
what part of the country are you in, Warren?
I'm in Connecticut. I'm not far from you. So I'm about 45 miles.
Good
outside.
Time to book your flights. Probably cheap.
Well, I had all my flights set up
before this.
Well, and they moved it back. And interesting, my hotel is half the price, so I got a refund.
Yeah, they didn't refund you on the airfare though, did they? You'd have to cancel the flight and rebook it, right?
Well, that's great because I have about a couple hundred thousand miles anyway on American miles, and then I have like four trips I had to cancel, and my daughter, my oldest daughter, lives in Salt Lake City, and she's coming home later this week. But could she fly American and use any of my tickets or miles?
Yeah.
Oh, because you'd have to go through Chicago.
Really?
So she's had, you know, we had to help her with it.
Well, when you cancel the flights, they put the miles back in your account, right?
They do, or some of them might have involved. But of course, you know, if you have kids, they the fact that she would have to change planes in Chicago, she didn't want the free ticket.
That's funny. Well, so are there any particular products that you are involved with right now that you're promoting that you can talk about?
Sure. So I've had a lot of hits. Obviously, I mentioned two of them, Stir Chef and Smart Spin. Our Stir Chef is a problem, but Smart Spin and Misto. With Lifetime, I've had a number of successful products. We have the odor absorbing splatter screen, which is basically a splatter screen, which people don't realize is probably one of the best selling items in housewares departments on the wall. Okay. Those generic ones, if you don't have a range hood and live in the city, that you can put over your pants so it doesn't splatter. And an inventor put a carbon charcoal filter in it that's washable and reusable. And it takes all the odors out. And we sold, you know, millions of those.
Okay.
The bagel biter, you know, the bagel guillotine that slices bagels.
Yeah, slice the bagel. Yeah.
Sold millions of those. They have the food huggers, which is a silicone end cap that goes over half tomatoes or onions that takes your tomatoes and probably gives them, you know, an extra 4 or 5 days of life. You know?
Is that the device where it looks like a tomato and it opens and you put the tomato in it?
Well, there's that. That's a little bit different. That's a little storage. This is actually just an end cap. It comes, it looks like more like a hockey puck when it's upside down. It just fits over the edge.
And it goes over the cut part of the tomato or whatever other.
That's okay. Correct. Because, you know, the skin's still on the other side. So all you have to do is protect. And basically what it saves you on a saran wrap. So you don't have to use foil or saran wrap.
Oh, okay. Like a lid for the...
And by the way, if you have dog food and stuff, you can slap it on the can. I mean, I've used it in the kitchen. And we've sold millions of those. And now Lifetime is an international company with divisions in Europe and Kitchencraft in Europe, and they own companies in Brazil and Mexico. And so all these products now are around the world. I have an unbelievable product right now that I'm not allowed to announce because it's top secret. We haven't signed the deal on, but it's a very, very cool, you know, device. I look at a lot of stuff. For inventors out there, you know, I can tell within a minute, you know, whether, you know, especially in the housewares field, what you're up to. I do have a process I go through, you know, unfortunately most things don't make it many times.
Think not, right? Yeah. Everybody's got a great idea. They think can be a business or a product and that's 9 out of 10. No.
Well, you know, I sometimes give those answers like it's already been done.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I had someone, send me a saucepan stirrer recently and I tried to explain to him and lost more money than you'll know. I almost lost my house on that. So please save your money. And they were determined to go ahead. Actually, it was at a trade show. And finally, I pulled the guy's wife aside. I don't know why I did this, but this is kind of what I do, and I guess it's a window into my soul. He was so determined, even after I told him all the problems. He goes, well, you didn't do it right. I'm going to do it right, you know, and I'm like, okay. I pulled the wife. I said, listen, keep an eye on him. You know, sometimes people go off the edge. You know, they get so locked into their.
Oh, my God. It's emotional attachment to their idea that they lose sight. They get blind.
And that's the problem. So you have to think about the psychological. And, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, when I got out of my stores, and you've probably been through this as an entrepreneur, you know, my stores were me, you know. I mean, they were, when I walked down the street, it wasn't, hello, Warren. It was like, Warren, you're the head of the Chamber of Commerce and you own the Good Food Store. That's who I was to other people. I didn't realize it at the time.
Right.
But that's who I was. And when I, for months after I got out of the business, I had no soul. You know, I didn't know who I was. I went through withdrawal of, you know, and who do I want to become? And so now at my age now, that's why I'm always looking ahead, you know, so I don't have to go through that again. Again, it's a learning experience. But, you know, if you're really a serial entrepreneur and you're really into these things, you have to be all in. You know, you can't go in the ring and not throw your best punch. But at the same time, you can't be goofy and crazy. You know, someone has to be around you and rein you in sometimes because, you know, let's face it. You know, if you're a gambler, you know, you're going to push it all in the pile and put it all, you're going to let it all ride and you're losing everything. And I have lost. I mean, I have a story, since it's an entrepreneurial effort, you know, when I ended up selling my food business and I sold everything in parcels, I ended up, you know, owing money at the end, a significant chunk of money. And it took me about 2 years to work it all off, but I was, you know, good for what I owed, you know, and I wrote everybody. And after I shut the company down and did all the things that, you know, I sold it actually and put all the public statements, months after that, trickled in were bills that came in from products from years old, where companies had shipped in product, maybe not included the invoice in the box, didn't have a sophisticated accounting system, and we didn't even know we owed the money. I never even had a record of it. You know,
right? This, yeah, sure. It's a little hard for them to now make a claim on a company that's out of business trying to pay its bills when.
Exactly. And the new owner who changed the business around was sending them on to me, and eventually, after a couple of months, there was like $30,000 of it, right? $30,000.
You probably couldn't even determine whether you really did owe that money or not, right?
Some of them were like from 4 years old, I'm like, and exactly, I didn't even have a, and so I'm sitting there going, I legally didn't have to do a thing, you know?
Right,
you know,
of course nothing. Not.
And, but I wrote every one of them. There were like 40 of them, and I wrote every one of them, and I said, I'll tell you what, I said, we did business for a long time. I looked up how much business I did with him. I said, I did like $70,000 with you over, you know, 7 years or something. You know, here's your bill for $500 or $1,000. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll split it in half with you to cover your cost.
Which is very generous.
I'll send you a check. And if you agree to it, like 28 of the 30 immediately wrote back, thank you, appreciate it. I cut him a check. We were done. We were down to two. One insisted, wrote me letters about how evil I was and everything. And I said, listen, you know, when you write me and get a better understanding in business for what I'm doing, then I'll deal with you. But until then, I'm putting you off to the side. Eventually, they wrote and they understood, you know, someone must have talked sense into them.
Like, of course.
Their mother sat them down to disagree. And then, but one of them was the story I'm leading to, which was, it turns out I owed like $1,700 for ice, okay, for catering jobs. Now, ice is water, you know.
Yes, it is in different form.
Yeah, exactly. And so there were bags of ice, and he had a terrible accounting, and the guy was all over the map. So he was a big tough guy, and you know, he one day, you know, because I was still running around, but I settled back into my cookware store, and he comes in like he's going to get his money, right? You know, and
oh boy,
I'm 6'3", 225 pounds, and I was an athlete all my life, and I don't go for that type of shit, you know. So I said, come on back to the cooking school, and I you know, sat him down. I said, listen, buddy, it's ice. We're talking about ice here, you know, and I don't have to do a thing, you know that. And he's like, at this point, he's like, calm down a little bit. And I said, I'll tell you what we do. I said, do you like cookware? He goes, oh yeah. He goes, I love cookware. I said, I'll tell you what, let's cut your bill in half. And I said, you go out on the floor and take $800 of the all clad cookware for your wife. He goes, oh, that's great. That's
right.
Great.
Which only didn't cost you $800.
Yeah, I got it for $400.
Right. Of course. No, that works for both parties, right? He gets $800 that he'd have to spend. Of course.
He was hugging, shaking hands.
That's not a screw in him. That's a win-win.
No, but that's the thing. If you're an entrepreneur, as you know, you get yourselves in these pickles and you got to sort of, you know, get through them and all that. And at the end of the day, I felt very good that I put everything to rest. You know, I don't think there's anyone out there. I mean, I'm sure there's people that pissed at me for one reason or another over the years. You know, I've done a lot of things.
That's just life. You can't avoid those.
I'm fairly aggressive, and, you know, I usually stand for truth and honor, and some people like it and some people don't. You know, it's what it is. But I did square all my debts. I'm very proud of that, and I never left anyone hanging at the end of the day. So that's an important thing, and that's a little bit of what goes in our business too. You get people taking money, not giving valuable service for it. You have a lot of inventors that run out of money. I was speaking at the Royal in Reykjavik, Iceland, for the Royal Icelandic Society of Inventors, and went out to
Royal
dinner.
Royal Icelandic Society of Inventors. Yeah. I wouldn't think such a thing existed.
Yeah, I went and met the ambassador, went to the embassy and all these things, and it was like they flew me over and all this stuff to talk to them. And they took me out to dinner, and they seated a woman on my left of me who had spent all of her like $24,000 that she had accumulated in savings for her life, for pension, in an invention with one of the invention, you know, marketers, and nothing came of it. And she literally, they brought her along to talk to me. I think that's half the reason they brought me over, like, what's going on in America? And she fell into my arms crying. I still have her tears on my blue blazer. Dang. And I was like, you know, you suffer with people when they do this. So it's, you know, you realize that cash flow is behind a lot of this, and I talk about that a lot in my book. So you know, it's inventors are a subset of entrepreneurs. They're
not all entrepreneurs invent. And by the way, not all small business owners are entrepreneurs. Just because you open a store, even if you're selling housewares and you're buying those housewares at wholesale and you're selling them, it doesn't make you an entrepreneur. It could make you an entrepreneur, but not everybody gets there.
That's exactly right. And first of all, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to be able to spell it. If you can't spell it, if you haven't taken the time to look at the word enough times to spell it, you can't be it. But I agree with you. And so sometimes inventors want to take the product to market themselves, and sometimes they want to license it. And so that's what I try. I say the vast majority want to license because they don't have the resources or the know-how and so forth.
Right.
So often I say there is someone that makes it big. I always give the Lord Dyson, you know, the Dyson vacuum.
Yeah, right. Well,
he went out on a limb.
But those are very few stories in the naked woods, you know?
Well, that's what I said. What does it take to become a Lord? I mean, he not only became a billionaire, he's a Lord. I mean, that's amazing.
Right. Well,
but that doesn't happen. You know, that stuff is
on. No.
So you know, the thing is as I say, watch your, you gotta be passionate, but watch your shekels. You know, you gotta be very aware of what's around you, you know?
And sure.
I think that's a big part of this. And this is what we try to educate people on at the end of the day. And unfortunately, people get pissed at me. I just did a show last week where I kind of called somebody out and they got all pissed and they're, you know, threatening to sue and all this stuff. It happens on. They market themselves, you know, and they cleverly, you know, in promotion marketing, they're inventor promotion companies. And you know, I could just say there's laws, there's the Inventor Protection Act of 1999, which calls out this type of thing. And
those are those companies where they say, hey, do you have a great idea that you think could become an invention? And you call them, you pay them and whatever.
For sure, it's those companies, but it's also others that promote their services and so forth. And there's sort of a how you define promotion, and I kind of define it of people who take money and charge inventors $2,000-$3,000, you know, for services that never work out. You know, they market from the hilltops about how successful they are, and they claim to give free information.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the inventors end up with nothing, and I have all these inventors come to me, and I end up helping them where I can, you know, for free, you know, at the end of the day. And so, you know, I as I go into my next phase, I'm going to do more to call those companies out, you know, and, do I do it under the UIA label or not? I don't know. You know, we have board members. I don't know how much everybody has a stomach for this. Everyone has a business.
Right.
So I might just do it with the book on my own. I don't mean to, when I speak on behalf of the United Inventors Association as an educational platform. Although educating inventors on what's out there and what's around them and what to be wary of, all I'm asking people and companies to do is open up your numbers.
Right.
How many inventors did you talk to? How much money did you take? How much success was there? That's all. You know, tell us that, and we'll let you be. Then you can be whoever you want. You know.
So, like, kind of like an advocacy pro industry group, a watch group, so to speak.
Yeah,
maybe?
I don't want to. I'm not a. I'm a free spirit guy as far as, you know, I don't want a ton of rules, but yeah, let's all do what's right, what's ethically right, and let's not hide behind the BS.
Well, those organizations usually work well when the honest people in the industry join, they open up their books. And then if you don't, it's assumed that you're hiding something. So,
That's a good point. That's a good point. So, you know, there's a lot of effort in that, and I may just stick to the book and speaking on the subject, but we'll see. But,
the message around and, you know,
but you know, I just tell you, anybody that if I'm doing the right thing or the UIA is doing the right thing, and we've been threatened before by companies to sue us many times. I mean, I had one a few years ago. I'll just say, first of all, you know, as a board.
Sue you for what? Helping people?
Oh, yeah. We had, because they claimed I was bad-mouthing their company. And I actually had a call with the president of the company. And I said, listen, I've never bad-mouthed you personally, but your business model leaves a lot to be desired. And I'd be happy to help you for free, consult you behind the scenes if you want to turn it into a more mentor-friendly organization. And, you know, if you want to sue our organization, by the way, we're all insured, we're all indemnified, and we have no assets. So if you want to sue me, I'm a big boy, you know, open up your books. I'm going to depose you.
Of course. And libel and slander, it's not libel and slander if it's true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not some firebrand who's out trying to start a fire. I'm just talking, pretty kindly and generically to get people on the same page. So anyway, do what everybody has to do what they have to do. But I just, you know, this is, doesn't come to me overnight. It's a lot of thoughtful observation, being very familiar with all the models in our business. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, Mitch, the inventors are susceptible. They're very naive, especially entry level. They're very naive.
Right.
They don't know what they're doing at all. A lot of them are having sort of an engineering background, know nothing about the business world.
Especially hard,
they
right?
They throw money at stuff, and they don't. Yeah. They think they're getting bang for their buck, or they're getting a return, and they don't have a chance. And some of them are quietly go. You know, it's funny. The inventors come and go like the tide in our industry. They'll come in, fail, and you never see them again. It's a continually changing landscape, but that's because they fail. You know, and nobody trained them or taught them the right way. Now, there's people that try to help, and there's some decent information out there, but I found by and large that the people that charge up front and want money no matter what, regardless of the financial success in the back end, you know, should raise an antenna and a red flag and should be looked at more.
Yeah, I find a lot of the, they probably don't think of themselves as inventors, but a lot of the people in the tech world, they're inventing, it's all tech-based, so they're inventing applications and apps for phones or whatever, a service, and it's the same thing. They're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and this is going to be the greatest thing, and I'm going to make, you know, money like Zoom is making now online and things like that. And it's the same thing. I mean, you got to go through the same process. You got to write a business plan. You got to go through the analysis. You got to figure out, you know, what's wrong with it. I would say if you're inventing something, you better figure out what's wrong with it. Why won't this sell? Why hasn't somebody done it before? What are the obstacles? Is someone else doing it?
That's right. You know, what's the problem?
Yeah. And they overlook the problems because they're so in love with the idea, thinking it's the greatest thing. I thought of this. And the worst thing you want to do is you invent the idea, right? They go to you, you put it on the shelf in your store, and your best friend walks in and goes, "Oh, I saw that online," like three, and pulls it up on his phone. And you're like, you're kidding me.
You know? So many of them. And it's so easy to go on Amazon today and find out, and yet people don't do it. But, you know, I don't know a lot about the app business, but I would think that if your app is going to be on an Apple iPhone, and you know, if that's the path to market, then you're going through Apple now. So they control that trade, and then you're going to have to live by the terms that they dictate. And I'm sure they don't do things that aren't in their favor. So, you know, you have to look at it. Like I always say to people, if you're going to invent a product for housewares that's interesting and novel, that's great. If we can manufacture, put it under different brands. But if you're going to invent a new blade for the KitchenAid mixer that can only be used on the KitchenAid mixer, that's very much limited, you know, your marketplace. And you've got to go to KitchenAid. That's your path.
Yeah, you know? You can't make something to work with their device without their permission, right?
Exactly right. So there's, you know, there's boundaries, and people have to get up to speed, and there's a learning curve, and you know, how do you get into that? And like we all know, even when we think we know everything, we still make mistakes. So the thing is just to learn, observe, and try to hang in there. And,
right.
And try to be, and to some degree, you have to be fortunate. You know, I was very fortunate.
That's all good advice. So for people listening out there, you've given them a lot of advice, but if they're working on an idea and they're, you know, looking for resources, I guess we'll put the UIA's website and your contact information in the show notes if they want to reach out, if they have an idea they want to talk to you about.
Sure. We'll try to get them headed in the right direction. If it's a housewares or hardware, or it's a DRTV product, you know, I can help them personally. Yeah. I don't charge. You know, if it's an area outside of my area of expertise, you know, exercise equipment or something, you know, we try to toys, for instance. I know a lot of people will.
Yeah, you can introduce them, right?
To the right people. If I don't know, I'll say, I don't know, you know, but I'll try to say, here's where you might find out.
Right.
Big and going to trade shows when they pick up again to learn your industry, go on Amazon, you know, obviously you can do internet searches, go to stores. I mean, there's a variety of ways. And in the book, I'll explain to people how they can, you know, get more involved, but you've got to learn as much as you can. If you're going, a lot of people think that they get an idea, they can sketch it out. And there's marketers are saying that, oh, we'll make a sell sheet and send it to a few companies. You know, when I get those sell sheets, there's not a snowball's chance in hell they're moving forward.
Right.
We had a recent marketer recently did a podcast with the president of Lifetime Brands. And so, you know, I don't know, 40 or 50 submissions came in after. They're all sketches and ideas. Not one of them made it past my desk. So, you know, there's a lot to learn. And by the way, there's no one way, as you know, as an entrepreneur. You could do all the right things and your product may not solve the right problem, or somebody beats you to market and you lose. So all I'm saying is you need to do all these things right.
Or it's a problem that nobody cares about. It's not, you know, it's not that important to people.
Sure. versus too niche, or exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you have, as an attorney, obviously I do this in New Jersey, but do you have like sample non-disclosure agreements for inventors to protect their ideas when they're talking to people and stuff like that?
Sure. And if anybody goes on my website, TuttleInnovation.com, any of my sites have non-disclosure agreements. The way I handle those, Mitch, is I basically represent several different companies. So I help them put together the non-disclosure agreement. And then I use the exact non-disclosure agreement that they form just in my own company's name so that we can set up a three-way. So I can be an independent. I have a non-disclosure obviously in place with the companies.
Right.
And then the company, and then the individual inventor signs both the companies and mine, and now we're all set to talk. I then use three different ones. All of them are very fair. One of them's 2 pages long, one of them's 4. Non-disclosures, great question. It's a very, very important and a red flag for whether a company's fair.
That's it. Like sometimes it's too costly or too difficult to try and enforce these things against a larger company. But if somebody's unwilling to sign one, that should raise a flag right there.
That should raise a red flag. And, you know, some companies, look, put right on their websites, we don't take outside submissions. You know,
right.
They don't want anyone, you know, they've had
right.
whatever
problem. Then they're coming back and say, hey, you know, I invented Star Wars. What are you talking about, George Lucas, right?
That's right, exactly. And yes. So they lawyers set that up, and they're the ones that make those calls. But other companies that engage, you know, what you want to do is analyze those businesses, and are they inventor friendly? Look at their website. Do they encourage you to come in? Are they fair-minded? Do they have other successes that you can look to and say? But one of the big things is look at their non-disclosure agreement. I know that one of the rival companies in-house was their non-disclosure is so onerous. I would never sign it. And I think at that point in time, inventors should use an attorney to take a look at that, you know,
right. Sure.
If it's really onerous, you know, I am not an attorney. I'm probably as close to playing one on TV as you can get, you know,
well, because of your experience in that one particular area. Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't claim to be one. And I want to make sure that people go to yourself or someone who's my daughter passed the bar in New York. So well,
there you go. Congratulations. Now you got one in the family.
Yeah, exactly. I always wanted one. I
have
one.
Right. Everyone needs one in their family.
One lawyer. One each.
Right.
But you know yourself that there's certain red flags and tip offs that you can tell looking at the website, engaging with people, what they say, what their history is, NDAs, all these type of things should be stuff that you should take into consideration as you look for the right company.
Right. Well, they can also contact you, right? And say, hey, have you ever worked with this company? Do you know anything about them?
Yeah. And I'll be real honest. If I know them, you know, I'm never going to say anything quite mean about them, but I might say, you got to look into this further and here's where to look.
Right.
People have to come to their own conclusions. I'm not, you know, here to, but,
right. I do know
every single person in our industry. I do know the DRTV industry. You know, I know everybody's stories. I know the Josh Malone Bunch of Loon stories where in the settlement he just made with Telegram. I know all these stories. So if I can recount factual stuff for people and help them there, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming on today.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.